God, please help me set aside everything I think I know about myself, my disease, these steps, and especially you. For an open mind and a new experience with myself, my disease, these steps, and especially you. How it works? Yes. 64. Great. Tonight we're on How It Works, and I'd like to introduce Tim.
Thank you, David. Recovered alcoholic named Tim.
Hey, Tim.
Welcome back, everyone, and to those who are new and a lot of fresh faces, welcome. I always start with my disclaimer. This is my experience, strength, and hope with the book known as Alcoholics Anonymous, commonly known as the Big Book. I do not speak for AA, but there are times when I sound like I do. And to that end, I apologize in advance. Last week we started on How It Works. And, we left off on page 66, but I feel that it's worth going back to 64 to recount some things. I always like to have a little bit of a story, a little anecdote or whatever, between the previous week and this week. And as it would happen, the Thanksgiving falls right in the middle of that. So I had a wonderful experience with step four stuff going on. Fortunately for me, I could recognize we can get to step 10 on it and reel to that sort of thing. We're having dinner with my family, and I invited some people. And I invited a particular person that has been in my life for a few years, and the relationship has been tumultuous, to say the least. That's probably the nicest way I could say it. And I don't know, for those who don't remember or who do, last week I talked about, page 62 talks about being driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, self-pity. And I always try to look at that as my self-car, my car of selfishness, I call it. And those are my four wheels right there. And I have my steering wheel of self-centeredness, and then I'm sitting in my selfish seat. And I was experiencing that on Thanksgiving. A previous discussion had come up. I responded to it, and then it became a piece of drama for Thanksgiving. Imagine that, an alcoholic's life, drama on Thanksgiving. And I allowed my self-car to be driven once again. And so I had to acknowledge that and look at, okay, now what was the nature of my role? Because I had a resentment. And it affected things of me. It affected all these different parts of self that we'll get into within the reading. So I had to look at my part in that. And my part in that, where was I selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, or afraid? And in this case, I was certainly driven by fear. And for me, fear, the best one that I like, there's all different acronyms for it, but for me, false evidence appearing real is always my favorite. Okay? Because that's where I start to get into the yeah buts in my head. Well, yeah, but this, and yeah, but that. So I was driven by that, and a button was pushed, and I responded to it because I didn't disconnect that button yet. And so here I was outside while my family and guests were saying grace at Thanksgiving dinner because I didn't feel grateful at that point, and I really didn't want to sit across the table from somebody. So it was interesting that I was like, oh, look at that. God's there again, huh? and I was talking about that last night. There was a sober dance, and I always enjoy the sober dances, because we're dancing, that's one. And sober, too. That's exciting for me. But there's always these wonderful recovery conversations that go on, when you go outside and you're sweating and you need some air, or, somebody's smoking. And it's really cool because, when I first started going, it was 19 and a half years ago, and I was actually a young person, right? So it's cool to see young people there and have conversations. And we got into talking about, God being present in things. And I noticed over the years, and I talked about this with a few people that I had known, that there's the God stories always have happy endings. It's always like, and I know God was working because I got what I wanted. And I thought, well, that was pretty interesting. For me, I had to recognize that a lot of times God's working, especially when I'm not getting what I wanted or I'm not getting what I need. There's that expression, I may not get what I want, but I get what I need. And that's a bunch of crap to me because I just get what I get. And it may not be what I need. So I have to recognize these things. So that was the past few days of my life. So it's really interesting to be able to have that and share that. That, you know, here I am all these years later, having an experience with this book, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of the steps, passing it on to other people, and yet life is still going on, and all of these things are still happening. I'm not levitating. I don't float through life, and I'm not perfect, and I'm not practicing these principles perfectly. And so I thought, wow, that was pretty interesting. And so I always like to share little anecdotes of my life to allow people to see that I am human. And I speak of the devil. that's wonderful. God is awesome. I love that stuff. That person just called. So, on 64. So, for anybody who doesn't know, what I like to do is the way I'm handling this is as if you and I were just sitting across from each other, and I was taking you through the big book alone. It just happens to be with a whole room full of people. So this is basically what you would get if I were sponsoring you. So 64, I'd like to start at the second paragraph where it says, "Therefore, we started upon a personal inventory." This was step four. And I wanted to go back to this because, you know, with Black Friday and all the money being spent, it always reminds me of step four. Because it says the business which takes no regular inventory usually goes broke. And I didn't see any businesses going broke this weekend, let me tell you. You know, so I thought it was interesting. And since taking a commercial inventory is a fact-finding and fact-facing process, it is an effort to discover the truth about the stock and trade. One object is to disclose damaged or unsaleable goods, to get rid of them promptly and without regret. If the owner of the business is to be successful, he cannot fool himself about values. And for me, that's really important right there. And I don't know about anybody else. It's very difficult for me to let things go, even if they're broken, because I usually have an emotional attachment to them, because it's all about me. It's mine. And if I let this go, well, then I won't have it anymore. And it won't be mine anymore, you know. And I've always heard the expression. I love it. You know, anything I've ever let go of has claw marks on it. You know, and there's the expression of let go or be dragged. You know, and often I'm dragged. So I always unsaleable goods to get rid of them promptly and without regret. And how difficult is that? Without regret, you know. Like, and for me, most of the time, it has to do with people. It has to do with relationships. And not necessarily romantically inclined relationships, but relationships in general, because that's one of the main reasons that I became an alcoholic, because of my inability to form successful relationships with other human beings. So I needed this. Alcohol did that for me. I was able to talk to you. And, you know, there's no way I would have been able to do this if I didn't have a few drinks in me, you know. And now it's because I have God in my life, I can do all these things that alcohol used to do for me. So that without regret, and that's always the thing when I'm going through this process with somebody, pushing that without regret. Because one of the nine step promises that we'll see later on, you know, is that we will not regret the past, nor wish to shut the door on it. And for me, that's come true multiple times, numerous times. You know, and the story that I told starting the meeting is a perfect example of that. That only happened Thursday. That, you know, that quote-unquote bad experience, because I don't think any experience is really bad. It was an uncomfortable experience, but I had to get rid of that person without regret. You know, and that's the hard part. So right now I'm trying to get through that process of like, okay, what's my part? And, you know, and then I pick up that bat and I start beating myself up. You know, I did this. I. And it's really not about that. So moving on. And it says, we did exactly the same thing with our lives. We took stock honestly. First, we searched out the flaws in our makeup, which had caused our failure. And I bring this up again. Nowhere in this process in the book does it mention assets. You know, because earlier in the reading it said we had to get down to the causes and conditions of what have been blocking us. And blocking us from our higher powers, what they're talking about. So there really are no assets that block us from God. That's what I've learned. You know, an asset would only bring you closer to your higher power, and mine, certainly. So if I'm looking for... An asset is not going to cause my failure, either. An asset is certainly going to cause a success. So I need to put those things out of my mind immediately. And so I look at that. And then, once again, I said this last week, and is it being convinced that self, and we leave out that next that part of the sentence, was what had defeated us. Okay, so being convinced that self was what had defeated us. And then he says, manifested in various ways. So, once again, we're back in my self car of the four wheels that we're driven by and all this wonderful self. So, self is what, I'm convinced that that's what has caused my failure. Self. In a whole lot of different ways. And then he says, we considered its common manifestations. Resentment is the number one offender. So here we are, we have this big pile of self, and on top of it, the most self we have is resentment. Right? And so it's the number, and then he says it destroys more alcoholics than anything else. So it just always amazes me, like here, resentment, and I talked about this also, that if you break the word down, sentire is Latin and it means to feel. And if you put an R-E in front of it, it means to do it again. So if you look at the word, resentment means to re-feel. Regardless as to what it is. It could be anger, it could be remorse, it could be jealousy, it could be anything. But if we're re-feeling it, we have a resentment. So I need to constantly be aware that I have resentments because that's the number one offender of what causes my failure. So if I'm stuck in a resentment somewhere, I'm going to cause failure in my life. So what am I going to do about that now? Okay, so then, and he says, Bill, he's really clear about why it's so important. It says, from its stem, all forms of spiritual disease. And like I said last week, he states the problem and the solution in two sentences. For we have not only been mentally and physically ill, we've been spiritually sick. Okay, so there's the problem. So now he gives us the solution. When the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. Which I just find that amazing. So if I get God, then I won't be mentally and physically ill anymore. And I couldn't believe that when somebody told me that, even when I read it the first 100 times. What are you talking? No, I have to do this, and I have to do that, and I have to handle my physical health, and blah, 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 blah. And then I got a lot of, listen, keep it simple, stupid. All you need to do is get God. No, there's more to that, you know. And as it turned out, that's really what it comes down to. Because when I have God in my life, I'm pretty straightened out mentally and physically. And it's when I remove God, you know, my ego pops up, edging God out, I like that. Then I have those problems. Then resentments pop in. Just like that story I told. Okay, God wasn't in that conversation for sure. It was me, edging God out, being driven by fear, false evidence appearing real, and anytime I have a fear, it's definitely about some sort of feeling that I'm feeling again. So I have this self-centered fear that causes this resentment. And that's going to destroy me. So I certainly wasn't spiritually fit at the time, and that manifested itself mentally and physically. Because physically I didn't feel like eating. And mentally, I didn't want to sit across from a person. I didn't even want to sit in the same room. So, right there, that spiritual malady in this little microcosm of an event in my life showed this proof right here. So then, okay, so now what are we supposed to do about it? Okay, and he gives us instructions. In dealing with resentments, we set them on paper. Now, I said this last week, and I'll say it again, and I'll continue to say this until there's no breath left in me. If you hear in a meeting someone say, you know, I never had a written fourth step, tell them to shut up. Really, shut up. You know, because that kills people. What that does is it enables people to say, oh, they didn't do that and they're sober 10 years, because we really don't know how sober somebody may be. I know if I spent 10 years and had never did a fourth step, first of all, I wouldn't be sober 10 years. I knew that for certain. And secondly, I would be so whacked out of my head that I couldn't imagine anybody listening to me in the first place. And it's amazing, we have a lot of that goes on in AA. A lot of people, they sit around and they don't drink and go to meetings and I don't do any of that stuff in that book. Shut up. You know, and because that I just, you know, I have personal things for that and I've spoken about them before. And so I need to be that, I'm responsible for this information here. It was given to me. I've had a spiritual awakening. I live my life as best as I can based on this. So I need to be responsible to it and for it. So at any time when there's somebody coming to dilute this message and say, no, you don't really need to do that. That's the, you know, they did that then. It doesn't work today. It was written in 1938. All that stuff that goes on, I need to step up and obstruct, as I like to call it. So, okay, so then he says, we listed people, institutions, or principles with whom we were angry. We asked ourselves why we were angry. In most cases, it was found out that our self-esteem, our pocketbooks, our ambitions, our personal relationships, including sex, were hurt or threatened. So we were sore. We were burned up. On our grudge list, we set opposite each name our injuries. Was it our self-esteem, our security, our ambitions, our personal or sex relations, which had been interfered with? We were usually as definite as this example, and there's that chart there. Now, I'm not going to go through the whole chart, but there's a couple things I want to point out. And Bill points it out later on, and I'll read that. You'll hear me say it. You know, fear is in the brackets of everything. And then you also have pride there, because that isn't mentioned in, you know, what it is that was affected. But there it is in black and white saying pride. So what I've learned, and I brought a whole bunch of papers with me this week. When going through lists and trying to find people, institutions, or principles, I have a resentment prompt sheet there that has those things listed. Because for some reason, I know when I have to sit down and do a writing assignment, my mind goes blank. And if you ask me, like, who I'm resentful at, I'll sit down and go, oh, no one really. I'm all right. But then if I have this piece of paper in front of me that says, father, stepfather, mother, stepmother, grandfather, grandson, you know, I'm annoyed at them, and I'm annoyed at them, and, oh, definitely them, IRS, oh, yeah, church, oh, yeah, them, you know, like, so there it is, black and white, and it shakes up my boggled brain, that I go, oh, okay, let me get all that out on paper. Because it's important, he says, in dealing with resentments, you set them on paper. And this is the first time in the step process where we're actually writing. Nowhere else in the step process up until this point are we actually writing anything. So I'm always amazed, though. I'm writing on step one. What are you writing? And where's that written? And I don't get that stuff. You know, and I'm writing on step two. I'm writing on step three. And I'm like, wow, there's a lot of writing going on. And what program is that? And, oh, well, my sponsor, they gave me this other book. And, well, what other book? Where's that from? Oh, well, it's from this place, and that's how they did it. I'm like, oh, my God. You know, so I sit here, and I say these things, so people hear, and Tim's opinion is that all that crap is wrong. I mean, that may work afterwards, you know, if you want to expand something, but as we read in the first time that we met, this is our basic text. Basic meaning the first thing that we do, no frills, and text meaning that it's a book for learning that has a mastery of a subject. That's what a text is. So if I have a basic text for Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm going to start there. I'm not going to go to calculus before I learn algebra, you know, or even my times tables, you know, like, so it becomes this, that really doesn't apply. And ladies, I'd like to say this, and it may sound a little harsh, but it's been my experience that more often than not, I've heard it expressed that the big book really isn't good for women in recovery. That it doesn't really apply to women in recovery. And I just think, well, what are you talking about? You know, because really, my experience, and I've sponsored women through this book. I know that's taboo, but, you know, I've taken women through this process because I'm mature enough that I understand the situation. And, there, you know, that's an individual thing. I don't promote you shouldn't, all that stuff. That's for everybody and their higher power or their sponsor to deal with on their own. But for me personally, I've taken women through this process, and any place where it said he, I said she. And any place where it said her or him, I said her. You know, I know how to change pronouns. You know, so they were able to identify with it because I'm reading it. And they go, oh, well, look at that. It does apply to me. And so to me, this is just such a wonderful book that is so universal that if we don't start here, we're not really... You know, it says Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the name of the book. Alcoholics Anonymous, and this is where we are. So if the book has a different title, it's not Alcoholics Anonymous' program. Oh, it may be adapted from, given permission to, but it's not Alcoholics Anonymous. So, you know, there's Tim's opinion on it. Okay, at the bottom of 65, it says, we went back through our lives. Nothing counted but thoroughness and honesty. You know, right? Those are two mouthfuls right there. We went back through our lives. I said this last week. For me, that was tough because I could remember back till I was three. So I had a lot of resentments, you know what I mean? But it was important. I needed to go back and do that because I can't flush that off. I hear a lot of that stuff too. Oh, if it happened before high school, don't worry about it. Well, why not? I mean, I know a lot of people who suffered a lot of trauma when they were 8, 9, 10 years old. That's before high school. And it was probably one of the main causes that brought them to Alcoholics Anonymous in the first place. So why would we ignore our whole life? If we can remember it, it's important. You know? So that's really important there. And then nothing counted but thoroughness and honesty. Thoroughness and honesty. And we read that honesty is really important in the first paragraph of How It Works. It's mentioned three times. So honesty. And then he just mentioned it in the page before. You know, it's a fact-finding, fact-facing process. You know, can't fool yourself about values. We did exactly the same thing with our lives. We took stock honestly. So it has to be thorough and it has to be honest. So, it's painful. That's why most people run from the fourth step, because it's painful. I didn't want to go through it. Well, that's not true. I did want to go through it because I was tired of being the jerk that I was. And when I saw this, I went, oh, this is going to tell me why I'm a jerk. Okay, cool, I want to do this. Because I didn't want to be that guy anymore. But that was just, I mean, that's not a common experience from what I've seen and experienced. So it's really important that nothing counted but thoroughness and honesty. Now, I know, for me, my first fourth step was not perfect. It was as thorough and honest as I could be at that time. And since then, I've done more. I've done other inventories because I want to continue to be successful in my life and in my recovery. So I need to do those things, right? And then he says, when we were finished, we considered it carefully. Considered it. What? Oh, uh-oh. We're thinking again. No, not allowed to think. You know, you hear that in the rooms. You hear that in meetings. Don't. If you're thinking, there's a problem. You know, well, it says right here, we considered it carefully, which means that we were thinking real closely. We were being soft with it. We were being purposeful with it. We're thinking about it. Right? And then he tells us what we should see. Right? I know that's another bad word, too, should. But he says the first thing apparent was that this world and its people were often quite wrong. And yes, they are. Right. He says to conclude that others were wrong was as far as most of us ever got. The usual outcome was that people continued to wrong us and we stayed sore. Sometimes it was remorse, and then we were sore at ourselves. And once again, that goes back to what I was talking about, that it's not necessarily anger that we're re-feeling. I mean, Bill even mentions remorse, so that's another feeling that we have that goes on. But the more we fought and tried to have our own way, the worse matters got. As in war, the victor only seemed to win. Our moments of triumph were short-lived. And you hear that a lot in the rooms. I don't necessarily agree with it, but I think it's worth mentioning that I hear a lot, would you rather be right or happy? And, you know, I still have a lot of work to do because I'd much rather be right. Because that makes me happy, you know. And naturally, that comes down to my pride. It comes down to how I want the world to see me. That's pride. So I fight a lot. That's the best I can say about that. So then, the warnings are going to start to come about resentments. It is plain that a life which includes deep resentment leads only to futility and unhappiness. To the precise extent that we permit these, futility and unhappiness, do we squander the hours that might have been worthwhile. But with the alcoholic, whose hope is in the maintenance and growth of a spiritual experience, this business of resentment is infinitely grave. We found it is fatal. For when harboring such feelings, we shut ourselves off from the sunlight of the spirit. The insanity of alcohol returns, and we drink again. And with us, to drink is to die. Okay? So those are like some ominous stuff. And I like that he repeats again. This business of resentment is infinitely grave. Now, I know for me, I don't know about anybody else, but when I have resentments, I have an investment in them. I have a personal investment in my resentments. You know, and it really, you know, you sit with it, oh, I have a resentment. You want to go out there? No, I have a resentment. Well, what are you going to do? I'm going to really think about it, you know? And that's going to change it, you know? So, and it's definitely infinitely grave. I don't know how. Resentments affect me physically, literally physically. My muscles start to tense, my face scowls, my shoulders hurt, my back hurts. You know what I mean? And so that's definitely infinitely great. And then sometimes it can be fatal, because I've watched people have resentments, and because they don't deal with them, they don't set them on paper, they don't look at their part, they don't look at why they have them, they don't give them to God, they don't go through this process, they drink again, and then they die. And I say this all the time. Alcoholics Anonymous is not like a seminar. It's not, you know, one of those other places that you go to a forum, quote unquote, for a weekend, you know. This is a life and death errand. If we drink, we could die. It's happened over and over and over again, you know. And the golden people, as I like to call them, the 90-day wonders who have home groups and they're sharing at beginner meetings and they have a coffee commitment and they're greeters and they're doing so well, and then they're dead. What happened? What didn't happen is really the answer. They didn't get God, they didn't do the steps, and now they're dead. Well, that's kind of dramatic. Well, no, it's real. It's a very real thing. And it's sad. I think that everybody who comes to Alcoholics Anonymous deserves to get this message that we're carrying here today. And if it doesn't get there, it's infinitely grave. I mean, I agree with these statements, right? And then here's this wonderful condition he gives us. If we were to live, we had to be free of anger. If we were to live. It doesn't say if we were to stay sober, if we were to not drink or use other mood or mind-altering substances. It says if we were to live. So if I'm angry, it's going to lead me to die. I mean, it's pretty plain, and he says that. The grouch and the brainstorm were not for us. They may be the dubious luxury of normal men, but for alcoholics, these things are poison. We good?
Yeah.
Poison. Poison. Being angry and being a know-it-all are poison. That's pretty, you know, those are ominous. Those are ominous warnings, right? We turn back to the list, for it held the key to the future. Key to the future. So, going back to those people who said, I never did a written four step. Well, what kind of future are they looking at? What kind of future? Their future is obviously locked. Because that says it right there. If we don't do this four step, that beautiful arch that we're going to pass through freedom that we talked about earlier on, because that's what we're building, this. It's the foundations and cornerstones and keystones of this new and triumphant arch through which we will pass to freedom. And if the door is locked and our freedom and our future are on the other side, we never do this, we're never going to see that. Okay, so where do I start? Cool. So then he said we were prepared to look at it from an entirely different angle. We began to see that the world and its people really dominated us. In that state, the wrongdoing of others, fancied or real, had power to actually kill. How could we escape? We saw that these resentments must be mastered, but how? We could not wish them away any more than alcohol. Wishing resentments, I've tried, please, go away. I don't want to feel this anymore. And it just doesn't work. It just doesn't work for me. I don't know how it works for other people, but it doesn't work for me. So then he says, this was our course. Colon, my favorite. Right? We realized that the people who had wronged us were perhaps spiritually sick. Imagine that they're spiritually sick. I thought I was the only one spiritually sick. Because it's all about me, after all. You know, I'm in my self-centered, selfish car, being driven. No, they're not sick. They're just a-holes or, you know, whatever. Like, I'm the sick one, don't you know? And then he goes on and he says on 67, though we did not like their symptoms and the way these disturbed us, they, like ourselves, were sick too. And then he gives us some instruction. He gives us a prayer. We ask God to help us show the same tolerance, pity, and patience that we would cheerfully grant a sick friend. When a person offended, we said to ourselves, this is a sick man. How can I be helpful to him? God save me from being angry. Thy will be done. And so there's a fourth step prayer. Right? That's wonderful. But, oh my God. Every time I read this, it never fails. Every time I read this, I always think of the Honeymooners, and I always think of Ralph Crandon. You know, that pins and needles, needles and pins, is a happy man that grins. And I ask myself, why am I angry? You know, and he starts doing it. And he goes, pins and needles, needles and pins. Why am I angry? You know, he just loses his mind, you know. I always think of that when I see this prayer. And, But for me, that how can I be helpful to him? Well, I could punch him in the face, you know, but he won't be bothering me anymore. And then, you know, he'll be sick and knocked out, you know. And then I won't be angry anymore, and I'll certainly be right. And so there's these things that come up. Now, I had a guy, when I lived in California, I managed a sober clubhouse. And there was a guy there who managed it, I don't know, like 2 months before I took over. And he relapsed. And so that was part of the reason why he didn't manage it anymore. Because it's funny, they want sober people managing their clubhouses. Go figure. So he had this resentment toward the entire clubhouse. You know, because they don't understand. And this place is for alcoholics. And how could you kick an alcoholic out for drinking? And it, you know, that justification, that wonderful... You know, he had a souped up self-car, you know what I mean? And so he would see me, and all of his ire would be directed on me, you know, like, because I'm the one who made him drink, obviously. And so one day, me and the second shift manager were in the office, and he comes in and he's all fired up, and he's ready to go. He wants any excuse for anything, right? And he's ranting and ranting and ranting. And he says, and I'll kill you, and I'll kill you, and I don't care, I'll kill you. And I sat there, and this was what was going through my head. This prayer was going through my head. And when he was done, I said to him, I said, what can I do to help you? And he just kind of looked at me. You know, like when you make a weird noise and the dog tilts its head. That's kind of how he looked at me. And he was like, I don't know. And then out he went. And the other manager said to me, he says, how did you do that? I said, do what? He said, he just threatened to kill us. And he said, how can I help you? I said, well, that's not me, man. That's God. God did that. I wanted to hit him with a chair. Okay, but I can't. That's not for me. If I want to live, I can't be a grouch. I can't be a brainstorm. That's the dubious luxury of normal men. And here was a perfect example standing right in front of me of what it does to alcoholics. And I didn't want to be that guy. So I had to go to my higher power and say, oh, man. Oh, yeah, this is a sick guy. Ooh, boy, is he sick. You know, save me from being angry. How can I help him? And it's so cool that when God makes those things come out of my mouth. You know, we were just talking about that before the meeting. God makes stuff come out of my mouth. Because I'm, you know, a selfish, self-centered, fear-based, self-deluded, self-seeking, self-pitying alcoholic when it's about me. So I constantly have to go to God. And we talked about that back on page 20. My constant thoughts need to be about others, right? And so then he goes on to say, give us more instructions. We avoid retaliation or argument. We wouldn't treat sick people that way. If we do, we destroy our chance of being helpful. We cannot be helpful to all people, but at least God will show us how to take a kindly and tolerant view of each and every one. And sometimes that's as simple as not saying anything and walking away. That's a kindly and tolerant view. Not engaging. And that, oh, try not engaging with a relative or a parent or a spouse or the clerk at the store. You know, try not engaging. You know what I mean? Like, so like, a lot of times, what a gift it is. Silence is an amazing gift from God, right? So, referring to our list again. Wow, we're going back to that list a lot, aren't we? Putting out of our minds the wrongs others had done, we resolutely look for our own mistakes. And here's what we look for. Where had we been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened? Though a situation had not been entirely our fault, we tried to disregard the other person involved entirely. Where were we to blame? The inventory was ours, not the other man's. Right? And then here's an instruction. When we saw our faults, we listed them. Ooh, we write them down. We place them before us in black and white, or green, or purple, whatever pen you like. Right? We admitted our wrongs honestly, and we were willing to set these matters straight. So there it is again. So there's another inventory we're doing. Our harms, our faults, our parts. So now we have our resentment inventory, and that's where we get our harms from. And within that resentment inventory, we look at how it affects us, the seven parts of self, and then we look at our part, where were we to blame, and we set that on paper. So we put that down. And then he goes on, remember I said this earlier, he says, notice the word fear is bracketed alongside the difficulties of Mr. Brown, Mrs. Jones, the employer, and the wife. This short word somehow touches about every aspect of our lives. It was an evil and corroding thread. The fabric of our existence was shot through with it. That's a pretty poignant picture. Imagine a huge tapestry with evil corroding threads shooting through it all over the place. You know, like I never understood when people say, I have a healthy fear. Well, how can an evil and corroding thread be a healthy fear? I mean, there's a difference between instinct and fear. And instinct is something that's learned also. You know, babies don't stop putting their hand in the fire until they put their hand in the fire. And it goes, ouch. You know, they learn from that operant conditioning part of things. And we all do that. So the fear, that instinctual survival thing, is there. That's God-given. But not wanting to go to a particular meeting because a particular person's there, or just these things that come up. If I don't do this, then I'll happen. This false evidence appearing real. All that stuff. When false evidence is appearing real, it's never healthy. My experience is it's never been healthy. When I'm stuck in fear, there's no faith. No faith. Because when it's fear, it's all about me. And one of the biggest ones is, it's for me, is losing people. Losing people from my life. Because I work really hard to become a better person, to become a better human being and a child of God. That I want people to notice that. And their life may have nothing to do with me at all. It may just happen across my path or pop into my life. So it's really not about me. So when that fear crops up, like somebody does something to me. Well, nobody really ever does anything to me. Sometimes things happen to me. And sometimes somebody may even, quote unquote, take an action against me. But like that story that I just told before about the guy who drank, his anger had absolutely nothing to do with me. Zero. Had nothing to do with me. So with that little prayer of going to God, it enabled me to face calamity with serenity. It gave me the power I needed to not live in fear. See, I had faith. I went to God. God gave me the answer. My colleague was living in fear. And cowering from the situation. So to me, it's like, wow, that's pretty much a no-brainer. If I'm stuck in fear, I got to go to God, right? And then he says, it set in motion trains of circumstances which brought us misfortune we felt we didn't deserve. But did not we ourselves set the ball rolling? It's a wonderful confrontational challenge there. We think fear ought to be classed with stealing. It seems to cause more trouble. Right? We reviewed our fears thoroughly. We put them on paper, even though we had no resentment in connection with them. Okay, so now we're up to a third inventory. We have a fear inventory now. Now, obviously, when we go through the resentment inventory, anything that comes up when we look at our part, where have we been selfish, self-seeking, dishonest, or frightened, anything that we check on frightened obviously goes on our fear list. Then we have, I also have a fear prompt sheet. You know, because I don't. If you were anything like me when you got here, I wasn't afraid of anything. You know, and then I said, "Well, okay, women and cops." You know, but you know, so, but then I learned, like, oh wow, fear. So I had this nice prompt sheet that I was like, "Oh yeah, afraid of that, afraid of that, yep, afraid of that, afraid of that." Fear of success, fear of failure, fear of dying, fear of living. You know, like just fear, one big ball of fear. I was a rolling fear ball. That, and I said, trains of circumstances. Trains. Wow. And they get going, man. They really get going. And I'm like, ah, and holding on. So I need to put them on paper. And then he gives us more instructions. We ask ourselves why we had them. Wasn't it because self-reliance had failed us? Self-reliance was good as far as it went, but it didn't go far enough. Some of us had once had great self-confidence, but it didn't fully solve the fear problem, or any other. When it made us cocky, it was worse. Right? Perhaps there is a better way. We think so, for we are now on a different basis. The basis of trusting and relying upon God. We trust infinite God rather than our finite self. We are in the world to play the role He assigns. Just to the extent that we do as we think He would have us and humbly rely on Him, does He enable us to match calamity with serenity? And I always talk about this, the Serenity Prayer. The first three words in the Serenity Prayer are God grant me. Not me grant me. Not I'm going to give myself some serenity. He's going to grant me that. It's a boon. It's this wonderful gift. God grants me serenity. God grants me acceptance. God grants me courage. God grants me wisdom. Because that's who... And why wouldn't I rely on infinite God? Infinite God. I'm like 5'8", 200 pounds. God's a lot bigger than me. Thank you. Cool. I don't have to worry about that? That's awesome. So when I go there, I'm stuck in my, you know, I'm running on my hamster wheel, you know. Oh my God, I'm thinking about it. I gotta do, I go, wait a minute. And I step off the hamster wheel and I say, God, can you do this? Because And almost immediately, my demeanor starts to change. I exhale, for one. That's a good one. Right? My shoulders drop a little. Maybe I could think about something else. Maybe I could think about where I'm supposed to be, who I'm supposed to help, instead of my little fretting and hand-wringing that I do. Oh, my God, like Piglet, you know? I could be more like Pooh. Winnie the Pooh, that is. You know? Thank you. Okay, you're with me. Good. So I can do these things, and I can just be. If I'm hungry, I can go and eat. How many people forget to eat? Anybody else? I'm the only one who forgets to eat through the day? I mean, you know what I mean? Like, I know a lot of you people forget to eat. You know, I'm sure you've had this experience of driving someplace and you have no idea how you got there. You know, because we're stuck in that hamster wheel thinking about what we have to do. And did I stop at that red light? You know, like... Did I leave the iron on? All those one, you know, that's how all these automatic shutoffs came, based on fear, you know? Right? Fear was a technological advance for the human race, I guess. Right? So fear, so God is the key to it, right? And then, and here it is, and I love this. This is a big... This paragraph for me gives me lots of strength. We never apologize to anyone for depending upon our Creator. Because I don't. I'm not apologizing for depending on God. No way. We can laugh at those who think spirituality is the way of weakness. Paradoxically, it is the way of strength. The verdict of the ages is that faith means courage. Now, I like to recognize that the verdict. Verdict. A verdict is a final judgment. All the facts are in, they're weighed, and then the verdict comes. So the verdict of the ages is that faith means courage. All men of faith have courage. They trust their God. We never apologize for God. Instead, we let Him demonstrate through us what He can do. We ask Him to remove our fear and direct our attention to what He would have us be. And here, look at this. Here's a promise. What's that promise? At once, we commence to outgrow fear. At once. At once. Wow, look at that. I go to God with my fear. I go to God with this. And at once I commence to outgrow it. Ooh, boy, God's powerful. That's really cool, right? So, and then he's going to get into, you know, the wonderful controversial subject. Now about sex. Many of us needed an overhauling there. But above all, we tried to be sensible on this question. It's so easy to get way off track. Here we find human opinions running to extremes, absurd extremes perhaps. One set of voices cry that sex is a lust of our lower nature, a base necessity of procreation. Then we have the voices who cry out for sex and more sex, who bewail the institution of marriage, who think most of the troubles of the race are traceable to sex causes. They think we do not have enough of it, or that it isn't the right kind. They see its significance everywhere. One school would allow man no flavor for his fare, and the other would have us all on a straight pepper diet. Here is AA's opinion. We want to stay out of this controversy. Bless you.
Thank you.
We want to stay out of this controversy. And then he repeats it. We do not wish to be the arbiter of anyone's sex conduct. We all have sex problems. The arbiter, the judge of anybody's sex problems. We want to stay out of that. That's a controversy, right? We'd hardly be human if we didn't. What can we do about them? Okay, so he's going to give us a suggestion about it. We reviewed our own conduct over the years past. Where had we been selfish, dishonest, or inconsiderate? Whom had we hurt? Did we unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? Where were we at fault? What should we have done instead? And look what he says. We got this all down on paper and looked at it. Okay? So, this, and we'll see it later on when we turn the page and I read, that it belongs with other harms. Where were we at fault? Okay, so these are questions that we ask about our harms. Where have we been selfish, dishonest, or inconsiderate? Whom had we hurt? Did we unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? Did we unjustifiably arouse that? Okay, so these are the questions that we have to ask about our harms, and specifically about our sex harms. In this way, we tried to shape a sane and sound ideal for our future sex life. We subjected each relation to this test. Was it selfish or not? Right? So now we have instructions going on again. We asked God to mold our ideals and help us to live up to them. We remembered always that our sex powers were God-given and therefore good, neither to be used lightly or selfishly, nor to be despised and loathed. Okay, so those are instructions. Those are AA's opinions and instructions right there. Now, I also brought one of the papers back here is the sex ideal. You know, with those questions, some other questions, and it's broken down a little further. You know, please take one of those because, you know, it's never talked about. You know, I ask people that all the time. Well, and for me, it's important because it's the epitome of my insanity. My sex ideal is the epitome of my insanity, okay? Because I created one, and I have one, and it's very short and it's very simple, and yet I continue to date people who do not fit it. That's insane. Insane. Right? I mean, it's simple. I literally have six things on my ideal, on my ideal, on my utopian partner. Six things. And they're gone. You know, like, it's tough, though, because when the things I picked were pretty idealistic. And I'll share them with you because I don't mind doing that because I think that's important. For me, I've tried to date Earth people, and it just doesn't work for me. So, she can't drink, she can't smoke, and she can't do drugs. That's three right there. Now, I don't think that's unreasonable, right? And because of my age and where I'm at and what I want in my life, and I may have to like change my ideal because maybe God doesn't want that for me. So I also have to look at that too. But it's my ideal, right? So she can't be she can't have children because I've done that, been there, done that, got the T-shirt, the hat, the bumper sticker, the keychain. You know what I mean? Like, because for me now, I love children, and I could be okay with a partner who has children, and the children come before me a lot. That's okay. I could groove with that. But the ex can't come before me. And my experience has been when I've dated, oh, good laughing, right? When I've dated single mothers, you know, and this big plan, you know, a nice weekend plan, money, we're going away, you know, a hotel. Every time, the child is sick. Phone call comes. Oh, they're sick. Okay, and? Well, we can't go. Well, why not? Well, the kid's sick. What, and he doesn't know how to take care of the child when they're sick? Is that... Oh, that's my child. Okay, so for that, I mean, if I'm going to keep doing that over and over and over again, expecting different results, I'm insane. Okay, so that's the reasoning behind that, right? So that's four. We got four on the ideal. The next one is she has to want to have children. Right? Because I'd like to have kids. I love kids. I think I'd be a great father. Okay, so there's that, right? So that's five. Right? And six is she has to want to get married. Wow, that's a deal breaker, huh? So there's that's my ideal. Six. Right? So what is that, you know, at my age, that kind of narrows it down to like four women left, you know? Right? But there it is, you know? I mean, like, it's six things on my ideal, and I still... Oh, you have a kid? Oh, okay. How old's your child? 28. Oh, okay, that's fine. And that's the truth, 28. Oh, good. And then I'm like, I'm in it again. I'm going, wait a minute. It's the same insanity. They're just older. Right? You know, there's a crisis. Okay, well, what do you want to do about it? Nothing. I just want you to understand there's a crisis. Okay, for how long? A month? I'm not dealing with a crisis for a month, you know. So, is it selfish? Probably. So that's why I have to subject each relationship to this test. Is it selfish or not? So if I'm in a relationship that doesn't fit those six ideals, obviously it's selfish. And I should, okay, well, you're beautiful, I like you, it's nice, good luck, God bless, I gotta go home. You know, and then I start to look at myself, oh, well, maybe I'm being intolerant, maybe I'm being impatient, maybe this, maybe that. But meanwhile, when I made my sex ideal, I was very cognizant to have God there with me. God give me my sex ideal. And I was able to take all the different things that I wanted in a partner and funnel it down to six things. I'm not that brilliant, but those six things came from my higher power and brought it down to that. And yet those six things I keep ignoring. And, it's amazing. Then I may meet a woman who like doesn't drink, doesn't smoke, doesn't do drugs, doesn't have any children, wants to have children, but she doesn't want to get married. I kid you not. So why would I stay? I know why I would stay. Because I have self-delusion. It'll be different because it's me. She'll want to get married because I'm such a great guy. That's self-delusion. I'm driven by self-delusion. Hundreds of them. Hundreds of self-delusion. So here I am again, emotionally involved with somebody whom I know I'm not going to be with. So I'm still insane. Oh, really? Oh, I thought I was the paragon of recovery, you know? So, and there it is. I mean, so it's really important for me to look at that, right? And then, and then he goes on to say, whatever our ideals turn out to be, we must be willing to grow toward them. Must be willing. Cheerful choice. A cheerful choice. Right? A happy agreement. Isn't that one? Oh, she has kids. Oh, sorry. Can't date you. I can't go out with you. But you have children. Well, that's mean. No, it really isn't. I'm sorry. If I go out with you and then I get involved with you and I get an emotional attachment to your child, that's really kind of mean for the child. Because we ain't making it. How do you know? I know. So I need to have God give me that courage not to be involved. Because I get involved all the time. Tim gets involved. God? If I let God take me to better things or different things even, I mean, that's a wonderful thing. So I need to be willing to trust God to help me bring that ideal, right? And then he said, we must be willing to make amends where we have done harm, provided that we do not bring about still more harm in doing so. In other words, we treat sex as we would any other problem. Okay, so that's where I got that from, black and white. The fault and the sex problems go on the same thing. It's right there. In meditation, we ask God what we should do about each specific matter. The right answer will come if we want it. And the hard part about that, I don't know if anybody else has experienced this. I get the right answer, and then I erase it. So I can, well, no, I didn't really get the right answer. That wasn't the answer I was looking for. It's kind of like a magic eight ball, you know? Outlook downfall, you know? Let me pick it up again quick. Yes! Oh, okay, good. Right. And here it is again. Yet another time he says it. God alone can judge our sex situation. God alone. Not our sponsor. Not our network. Not our home group. Not anybody else. Not mom, dad. What? God alone. Right? Counsel with other persons is often desirable, but we let God be the final judge. So that's twice. In two sentences, he says, where we go with our relations. You know, because I'm still looking for it, you know, that stay out of relationships for a year. Those types of, you know, okay, there may be some soundness to that, but it becomes puppeteering. I've watched. That's what it becomes. Oh, they don't know. Tim's opinion. Tim's opinion is you should stay out of relationships until you do a fourth and a fifth step. That's my opinion about it. But I encourage people to get into relationships early in recovery. Because why do you say? So you find out your defects of character real quick. You know? And for years, I always hear these wonderful stories. You know, you sit around, and anytime this part of the book comes up in a big book study or whatever, you know, people, they raise their hand and they share their experience, their strength and their hope about that this relationship that they had in their first year of recovery, or that relationship that they had in their first year of recovery. And I'm sober 15 years! And you look at them and you go, so you survived that relationship that you weren't supposed to have your first year, and you're telling other people, don't get into a relationship in your first year. You know, I mean, alcoholics have a real keen sense of hypocrisy. You know, and so I always think, I always sit and I smile. Like, really, they're telling people, don't get into relationships. And then you have people, and then, you know, because I see and I hear things, you know, I listen and look twice as much as I talk. So you can imagine how much I do. Right? And I know things about people in the rooms. Because people just go, hey, guess who I was with last night? You know, and, you know, I can hear the sun come up. That's how good my hearing is. So I know things about people. And so they'll sit in a room and they'll stand on their spiritual hilltop and be the arbiter of other people's sex conduct and get into that controversy and tell people, you better stay out of a relationship, when I know what they were doing yesterday. You know? So to me, it becomes about, okay, when it comes to those things, here's what I tell people that I sponsor. And there's a person in the room that I sponsor, so you can ask that person after the meeting if you like, if I'm lying. I say, listen, you can do anything that you want as long as you're willing to pay the consequences. Consequences are yours. You know, because, and I say that to people who are usually over 18, which means they're an adult, and they could fight and go to war and vote and be arrested, and they're responsible for themselves. So this whole parenting thing that goes on between a sponsor and a sponsee, or, you know, that... one of the things that I hear women say, and I apologize if it sounds chauvinistic, is that, my girls. You know, when women have a gaggle that they sponsor, and they call them my girls. It's not your girls, they're adult women that you're sponsoring, and you don't own them. God's giving them to you to take care of, so stop acting like a mother. Do you have children? Yes. Well, mother them. I mean, I'm not here to be anybody's father, that's for sure. I'm more than willing to help out with anything I might know about. If I don't know, listen, I tell people that I sponsor, listen, if you want to learn how to, like, go out, if you want to learn how to, like, go on a date, if you want to learn how to, like, have a good time, I can help you with that. Okay? But don't ask me how to have a a successful relationship. Because I don't know how. I don't. I have no idea how. It may be successful for a little while, but I'm married and divorced. And I'm single currently, and every relationship I have, it ends. Okay, so I'm not an expert on it. I say, you see that guy over there? He's been married 50 years. Mm-hmm. Go ask him. Or you see that woman over there? She's been married 30 years. Go ask her. Because to me, they know. I'm not going to go to somebody who's bankrupt in a furniture business and ask them how to run one. Listen, I know you lost all your money trying to sell couches, but do you think you could tell me how to do it? No way. No way. Absolutely not. You know, and I try to look at that from every different perspective that I go through. You know, if I want to know about how to be in shape, I'm going to go to somebody who's in shape and goes to the gym and knows how to work out and knows about nutrition and ask them. I'm not going to go to somebody who's rotund. I'm just not. You know, I go through my roundness because I go back to the same thing. I go back to my old way of thinking. I haven't had an entire psychic change as the result of steps where exercise and nutrition are concerned. I know all about it, but self-knowledge doesn't keep me skinny. Okay, so it's kind of the same thing with sobriety. I know I'm a recovered alcoholic, but that's not going to keep me from my insane thinking that's going to bring me back to, well, I got this. I have nothing. God's got it. When I have it, whoa, we're in trouble. But when God's got it, the right person has it, right? Okay, back to the book. And he says, suppose... we realize that some people are just as fanatical about sex as others are loose. We avoid hysterical thinking or advice.
You better not go out. I'm not going to spot you.
Right. Got to avoid that, right? Mm-hmm. Suppose we fall short of the chosen ideal and stumble. Does this mean we are going to get drunk? Some people tell us so. Vehemently, too.
You're going to get drunk.
Right. But this is only a half-truth. It depends on us and on our motives. If we are sorry for what we have done, and we have the honest desire to let God take us to better things, we believe we will be forgiven, and we will have learned our lesson. If we are not sorry, and our conduct continues to harm others, we are quite sure to drink. We are not theorizing. These are facts out of our experience. And I can attest to that. I've watched people do that. I've watched people weasel, as I like to call it. They weasel. You know, they say the right things to the right people who are in vulnerable states and continue to do this for years and years and years. And then they get drunk. And then they can't get back. And they're at meetings and they have 6 days and then they have 7 days and then for years, right? Then he says, to sum up about sex, we earnestly pray for the right ideal. There's an instruction. For guidance in each questionable situation. More instructions. For sanity. And for strength to do the right thing. Okay, and then here's a nice warning, and I love this. It says, if sex is very troublesome, we throw ourselves the harder into helping others. We think of their needs and work for them. Right, now, if I just stop there, I could spin that and say, well, I'm really helping her. I'm really thinking about her needs, you know. Right. But then and then he says, well, why do we do this? He says, okay, this takes us out of ourselves. It quiets the imperious urge when to yield would mean heartache. And it doesn't say for the newcomer. It says would mean heartache for anyone involved. So that's really key for me to remember that. If we have been thorough about our personal inventory, we have written down a lot. Right? It drives me crazy when I hear people say, you know, my sponsor said if your inventory is more than a page, you're doing it wrong.
Uh-huh.
What? A page is not a lot. You know, like 15 pages is a lot. Maybe. I mean, if you're honest and thorough about it, you've written down a lot, right? It says, we have listed and analyzed our resentments. Listed them and analyzed. Wait a minute. Are we thinking again? We've got to stop doing that, right? It says, we have begun to comprehend the futility, their futility and their fatality. We have commenced to see their terrible destructiveness. We have begun to learn tolerance, patience, and goodwill toward all men, even our enemies. For we look on them as sick people. We listed the people we have hurt by our conduct and are willing to straighten out the past if we can. In this book, you read again and again that faith did for us what we cannot do for ourselves. We hope you are convinced now that God can remove whatever self-will has blocked you off from Him. If you have already made a decision, step 3, and an inventory of your grosser handicaps, not assets, step 4, you have made a good beginning. That being so, you've swallowed and digested some big chunks of truth about yourself. Right? Now, for me, that's a lot of, did I want to get rid of that. Those huge chunks of truth about myself, oh my God, they were, ugh. And that's what's great about the fifth step, because we can go vomit on somebody now. and it's important, you know, we have lists, and it's the key to our future. The key to our future. It unlocks our future. You know, I love this process, and I hope that comes through. And for me, you know, like I said, I brought some things, you know, definitions on the fourth step. All 3 sheets for the inventory. There's a resentment, a fear, harm, and sex harm. All the questions. You know, I try to, it's funny, I always talk about thinking, but I try to remove the thinking for people. And I didn't make any of these things up. There's other people out there who are just as maniacal about as I am about this process. And I thank God for them because they made my life easier. So what, you know, this process of doing the fourth step, of sitting down and doing resentments, fears, harms, and sex harms, it can be done in a day. It can be done in a day. I know people, they write 25-page term papers and stuff like that in a day, but yet they don't want to sit down and remove all the crap that's blocking them off from God, that's blocking them from their future to become the person that they're supposed to be. Now, what I end up doing is that, you know, I go through all this up to this point, I give the person I'm working with these papers, I pat them on the butt and send them off, and then I make an appointment with them. And it's either 2 weeks or 3 weeks. That's all you have. If you haven't done your fourth step in 2 weeks or 3 weeks, I say, go find somebody else, because you're half measuring it, and I don't want anything to do with that, and somebody else may want what I have to offer. I may be depriving somebody else of that. Okay, and it's so, you know, doing this work, it's so fulfilling. It makes me uniquely useful to other human beings. You know, my God has given me the ability, because of my experiences, to help save lives. I mean, most people, oh, well, that's egotistical. No, it's not. No, it's not. God does that. I'm just an instrument. I've been given a brain that I can understand these things, and I'm articulate, and I'm eloquent at times. That's not me. That's my higher power. God has done all of that for me. I can assure you that, because I'm, oh boy, I'm still thin. You know, when I'm working for my higher power, it's a good time. For everyone involved, that's for sure. You know, so so help yourself to the papers after the meeting. Use them, please. If you're sitting on the fence and sitting on a fourth step, find somebody who knows this book like this, go through it. You know, listen to the recordings. There's other ones that are up there that could probably take you through it the same way I did, I'm sure. But this is it. This is the beginning. This is the launching into working out and becoming spiritually fit. Right? So that's it for me tonight. I hope I helped somebody tonight, and thank you.